And welcome to another edition of the Business Buzz. We have Doctor is not in, but we'll give Dr.
Next week.
Kina.
Next week.
Dr. Kina is in studio.
Congratulations.
As well as,
wow.
There you go. And as well as Chris Calandra. We have a really special show today. Chris, it's been a while since Walt Hampton was on. I think he's one of your favorite people.
One of my absolute favorite people. And he's not going to be on, I guess, right?
Nope, but booked. Being the heck of a guy he is, a referral from him, that's, the bar is pretty high. It's Dr. Bridget Cooper will be on our show momentarily.
Nice.
And she is a motivational person, change agent, just like our good friend Walt Hampton. So, and it's kind of like, gentlemen, what I was thinking, and the reason why I was going to have Mr. Hampton on is, kind of coming into the new year, and really with the theme that I really wanted to talk about was how do people deal with the disappointments of the year, meaning things that they might have tried to put into play that didn't come to fruition. So how do you turn that into positive energy? So without further ado, we have Dr. Cooper. Dr. Cooper, you were there.
I am here. How are you?
Oh, not bad. As Chris was saying before we came on air, no relation to Sheldon Cooper, correct?
No, but I would enjoy that relationship.
Yes.
Immensely.
You know, we were talking about the show. Do you still watch the show?
I do. My kids absolutely love it.
You know, I was a huge fan. But you know how someone can, plant a seed in your head?
Yeah.
So I was talking to a friend of mine, just talking about this, that, and the other thing. And he was saying, Big Bang, I think, has kind of run its course. And then I started, thinking, it's kind of like, played out a little bit. It's not the same show as it was.
It's not the same show, but I don't know. I mean, I living close to Springfield, Massachusetts, and The Simpsons has been going for,
I would say that's 30 years.
Well, I didn't want to date it because it came out when I was in high school. So can we not do that, actually?
No, it was 20 years. There you go. So, as I was saying, I don't know if you heard, I was talking to the it's Studio B about, the theme that we'll start off on, and then we can get into whatever we explore, other themes as well, is that, I'm thinking that many people have obviously New Year's resolutions. The biggest thing is, I'm going to get into shape, and gym memberships go skyrocketing, and then they plummet. People, do it for a month. But I'm thinking a lot of people set out, 2017 is going to be the year of X, Y, and Z, I'm going to finally, meet someone, or I'm finally going to get that better job. The list is exponential.
Right.
But I'm thinking most people, I would think, and you're the expert, not me, I would think most people do not come close to meeting the aspirations they think for the coming year, correct?
Yeah, I think it's chock full of inquiry there when you start asking that question or posing that dilemma. I think there's a number of things you hit on. I have known a lot of people, myself included, who have exceeded our expectations for years. But the things that we do in the beginning of the year to equip us and along the way to equip us to get there are many. And we can dig into some of the things that we can do as we look back. But I want to answer the primary question that you had, which is, how do you not get sucked into this self-deprecating, self-abuse place when you're looking at, oh my goodness, it's already almost mid, November, and I'm almost at the end of the year, and I didn't accomplish what I set to accomplish. How can I use that energy could kind of send me under to propel me up?
That's it in a nutshell. Yes, and it might not just be 2017. It might be obviously, if someone's, an adult, in their 40s or something.
Right.
And it could be a series of 3 or 4 years that, here we go again.
Yeah, here we go again.
It's not happening. So let's stick to the first premise first, and that is, how do we, first of all, not have, self-deprecating behavior and emotions? Let's talk about that first before we get into how do you flip that.
Right. So, okay. So how do you not get there? To me, when I deal with my clients, because I do a lot of coaching, both group and individual, and we talk about this idea of regret and how it really saps our energy, because there's absolutely nothing you can do to go back in time to redo anything that you have or have not done. And what's more useful is to look back, and as a lot of companies do, which is they explore something like a lessons learned.
Mm-hmm.
What can I learn from what I have and haven't accomplished? Not what can I regret about? Because regret is just throwing energy into the abyss. There's nothing that comes out of regret.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all negative energy. It is that soul-sucking, you know, self-abuse place.
Can I interject a thought about that? Because there was someone very, very smart who had a, I thought was a really brilliant concept, and maybe you can elaborate on this if it's, you know, if there's any credences. He says sometimes, you know, that kind of thinking, like, you know, I should have, could have, or I can't, you know, whatever, even like getting bummed out, is oftentimes an excuse for inaction. That's not what I'm saying. That's what this gentleman I knew, very accomplished, said. And I thought that was kind of profound. What do you think?
It is profound. I mean, I think it. We end up having these self, what I call narratives about who we are and what we do, and they can either limit us or they can create brilliance and magnificence, right? It's how we narrate that. So if we narrate up, another year come and gone, another set of objectives, you know, lost and left on the wayside. Yes, if that's our narrative, it does become a self-fulfilling prophecy and an excuse for not doing anything, because that's how we've set it up. We've set up that that's who we are, and therefore that's what we do, and therefore that's how life works.
Interesting.
So if we can shift that narrative, which is a lot of the work that most of us need to do, which is to question and then shift the narrative of how we're describing things, we can change everything.
Okay, before I throw it out to Studio B, let's just focus on that one little segment right there, and that is how any strategies to shift that, because I believe many people do that, like, oh, another, you know, another failure, another year of unfulfilled whatever, X, Y, and Z. So any strategies to flip that?
Yeah, so two things I want to focus on. One is looking at, were the things that you were setting out to do in your control or not? So if we say, I'm going to meet someone. Well, okay, that might be great. Did you meet anybody? Or did you just stay in your house all day and, you know, go on Netflix marathons? Well, that's going to be tough to meet someone. So did you do things that were in your control to be able to shift some of the outcomes? Knowing that not everything's in your control. You might have done all the things that you thought to do, but it didn't happen.
Actually, can I interject one more thing? I think that's fascinating. Gentlemen, I think you kind of would agree with this, is that that's really very interesting and insightful, is even if it, let's say things didn't work out, but if you do the, let's say the reboot of it, and you're saying to yourself, gee, I did go out, I went on, you know, whatever, I went out there, whatever it is, or I did apply for a job or whatever, that was in your control and you did it. Now, you might not have gotten a job, you might not have met someone, but the things you were in control of, you did accomplish. So maybe that's a good way to maybe separate. Maybe actually, yeah, I didn't achieve my objectives, but it wasn't my own failure.
Right.
That
and
makes sense,
that
correct?
We don't want people to be results focused, because of course you want people to be results focused, but your control is in the action. It's in the process place. So if you are in action, if you are focusing on process, focused on, of course, the results and the outcome, knowing that you're not always in charge of those, they may be bigger, they may be less than what you'd hoped for, at least then you're in the game.
Mm-hmm. That's funny, because I actually read when I was out of college a couple books by Wayne Dyer. I was kind of a big fan until he kind of went off the deep edge. He got a little out there.
He got very spiritual.
You know, I like one thing he said, because I was very achievement oriented when I first got out of college. He's like, it's kind of what you're saying now. Suspend yourself, something to that. Suspend yourself from the actual result, because that, like you're saying, that's not in your control. Do everything you can to position yourself to win, but you got to remove yourself from the actual event, because you are not in control of that.
You're not in control of the ultimate outcome, but you are in charge of the inputs that you do. And a lot of people, like you said, see that as an excuse of, oh, I didn't get it, therefore either I'm not worthy, or the world's against me, or I'm, you know, something's wrong when they haven't actually analyzed the right part of it. They've been looking at what didn't happen versus what did they do or not do to affect that result. And that's really where their control is. And the other thing, so I had two pieces. One was that control focus. And the second one is when people look at anything in their lives, and this is about shifting that narrative, is they make a statement, and we all love to be experts, right? We like to be right all the time, even if we're right about really awful things and really awful judgments. We love to be right. And I often say to my clients, would you rather be right or would you rather be happy? And so if we can look at a statement that we've made and simply my, what I call the big or, that one little word, O-R, and say, okay, here's the statement I'm making, or, and just question if there's another way of looking at that same experience.
Could you give me an example of that?
So, okay. So, I wanted to have a better job. So my statement might be at the end of the year because I didn't get that better job. I'm not capable of making a positive change in my career. Or I didn't put in the right amount of effort in the right areas to get the outcome I was looking for. Or, you can throw as many of those in as you want. Or the economy's really tough in Connecticut in my sector. Maybe if I looked in another sector, I might see a different output.
So you're saying kind of parse it so it's not a complete disaster. You're saying,
yeah.
Or, yeah, could it be Connecticut kind of sucks for jobs? Or whatever. There was a lot of bad weather and I'm in construction. Whatever it is. So don't look at a sum total of a failure, but or. Is that
or
what you're saying?
It's really about flexing your thinking because we're so wedded oftentimes to our judgment that we see something and this is the way that it is. If I asked 100 people, they'd probably give me 50 to 100 different responses to the same exact experience, which means that the way you're seeing it may not be the full story. And if you can just throw an or in at the end of your statement, it forces you to be more flexible in your thinking, which allows you the opportunity to shift that narrative.
So, Dr. Cooper, this is Chris in Studio B. Great, great discussion. It's a pleasure having you on. So you use the term narrative. So is that the same thing as I would use the term like self-talk? We all have that voice inside of our head that can sabotage ourselves. Is it kind of the comparable term? Okay.
Let me share how I see the difference.
So okay.
Self-talk is a practice, right? It's a practice. The thing that we do, it is in little bursts. It comes up in great moments and in bad moments. It can be used against us or for us. A narrative is like stringing together all of those moments of self-talk and what the story looks like. So we know a lot of people in our lives, whether personal or professional, who are in a overall victim narrative. Everything
right.
happens to them. Nothing happens for them or by them. And that's a narrative. The self-talk creates the narrative, but it's a building block of the narrative.
Real quick, in your practice, what percentage of people fit into that category? And any insights in why? Because it seems very self-destructive. Why is that able to happen? Or why do they let it happen?
Yeah. So I would say as a percentage of my practice, not for long because I don't listen to it.
There you go.
I mean, I listen, but only for so long because I know that it takes away their power. And what I'm in the position of doing, the purpose of my practice is to create powerful people so that we stop having victims in our world, so that we have everyone acting in their own full power. So they're not there for long. And what creates that is, again, it's really in language. It's in the way that I love what you said, Chris, about self-talk. It's in the way that we talk to ourselves and talk about ourselves and talk about others that creates and reinforces that narrative. So slight shifts in the way that we speak can be absolutely powerful and transformational in the results that we have in our lives. Little shifts in language, very tiny, just flexing, you know, like always and never to sometimes and maybe. Something like that, you'd be amazed, can shift an entire person's persona and ideas about the world because now they're not fixated on that right versus happy piece.
Hey, Dr. Marty Kina here in Studio B as well.
Hello.
And, you know, I've been thinking, you know, that most of our talk has been about individual motivations for individual growth.
Yeah.
I've been making a trying to think through in terms of the same concepts being spoken of in terms of building relationships between people. And, you know, as a dad who, you know, lost, you know, contact with his children through divorce over a number of years, and now there's been this kind of guilt or whatever the word would be in terms of not feeling like you had the relationships that you wish you had had. And then what kind of actions were being taken in order to build those relationships. And again, maybe this is what a lot of other people are dealing with. And is there an idea of this idea of a confirmation bias, not necessarily a self-fulfilling prophecy, but the fact that we take information in to support whatever idea it is that we're trying to believe in, and that oftentimes we overlook other pieces of information that might have been an opportunity?
Absolutely. I mean, I think...
Very good question, by the way.
Yeah. what I see with people, and what the basis of all the work that's done is looking at the fact that we all have mental models. We have mental models that are basically a filtration process that we take in all information, all activity, all feelings, everything we see, feel, touch, smell, whatever, in through these mental models, these filters. And we have early experiences that create these mental models that then, like you said, confirmation bias, we're looking at the world through the filter. If I asked the person standing next to me to look at the same situation through their filters, they might see something very, very different. And it, again, if we are only looking through our filters and not allowing in a possibility of another filter making either more sense or serving us better, then we get locked in to a very reactive state in all of our relationships, both intra and interpersonally.
So what would be the risk there for that individual that was trying to break through that blockage of being able to absorb other options?
I think the biggest challenge is that, depending especially on their age and the kind of history that they've created, is having to wrestle with that evil thing of regret, of looking back and saying, boy, I've been wrong, or I didn't look at this other option, this other way of thinking. Now I have to look back on what has happened over the last number of years and take responsibility for the fact that if I looked at it differently, I might have behaved differently. Mm-hmm. And for me, when I work with clients on this, because that's usually the biggest block, is that if they can stay in their current way of thinking, at least they're right and they don't have to risk being wrong and having that regret, is looking back again from that filter of not regret, but lessons learned. Okay, so I didn't have the information that could shift my thinking. I wasn't working with a coach. I wasn't working on, you know, self-improvement. I didn't have this knowledge. Now that I do, now I'm making the most of what I have, which is the present moment, and trying to influence future moments and making that shift. But that's usually the biggest roadblock, is that fear of regret, of awareness that we could have done something differently had we known.
Now, I thought that was a really good question. I have something else. This is Jeff again in Studio A. You talk about, you know, people attempting or trying to achieve a goal. Something else I read that I thought was interesting, and I wanted you to reflect on this from your own practice. Do you ever notice or see a lot of people have these preconceived notions like, oh, I'm too young, I'm too old, I'm too this, I'm too that, but they've never really investigated if it's true or not? Like, oh, that's impossible to do, or I don't know, that never happened. You know, these concepts, and it's kind of like, do you ever ask people, first of all, have you had that, have you seen that? And number two, have you ever asked them, why do you think that's true?
Yeah, so I see it a lot, and absolutely do I ask them, you know, do I challenge that assumption? But most of that is based in the premise that people want to be in control. We have a need for being in control. It's a survival mechanism. If we didn't have any control in our lives, we'd be dead, right? We'd starve to death. You know, all sorts of bad things would happen. And when we take those assumptions and make them a reality, and they box us in, they create a more manageable space in which to exist. So it limits us, and it also makes us feel real safe. So when I'm challenging people on those assumptions, I'm not wanting to, I mean, I call myself a cage rattler for a reason. I'm not trying to blow the doors off of everything right away, because that can threaten someone's sense of safety. But I do want to investigate why, you know, kind of challenge the assumption, because I know that it's keeping them safe, and I know that I have to help them see the kinds of risks that they're willing to take to be able to see it a little bit differently, to be able to take that next step to investigate, even, is that really true? Is that really the way?
So in your work as a cage rattler, so that's, like you said, provocative, and that could be for some off-putting, and for others that could be really exciting if they're looking for change and want to go in a different direction. So can you talk about who seeks out your assistance and some of the basics that you do with each client of yours to help rattle their cage?
Yeah, so I love that you asked that question, and I when I first realized that that's really who I am and what I do, I had to recognize that there's a red rope. There's a red rope of people who are going to see that, and that's going to resonate, and that's going to make sense for them to
right.
work with me. And there's going to be people on the other side of the red rope that don't want anything to do with it, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to find somebody who fits them better. I am a cage rattler because I am passionate about relieving the pain that people are in. So to answer that piece of who comes to me, people come to me because they're in discomfort. Something is not working. Something is, or a number of things sometimes, are not working in their lives, and they're in discomfort or often pain. It might be a professional thing, show up as a professional piece. It always relates back, because people are people, to a personal issue. So it's always blending between the two. So I get in there with people and help them to identify where that source of pain is coming from, and what, again, we work on a lot of mental models, what mental models are creating and recreating that same pain over and over in their lives, and how can they shift some of those mental models to be able to shift their feelings then, and then, of course, their behavior.
So can we go to the beginning? So let's say I'm intrigued by the cage rattler, and I'm in pain and struggling. Let's just assume it's something professional in terms of getting ahead in the corporate world, or getting a job I find fulfilling, something along those lines.
Right.
So then do we meet? Is there an initial meeting?
Yeah, so we would talk on the phone.
Okay.
Because I have clients all over the country and in other,
I see.
Other countries, I find that people are... they're not worried about whether or not they're crossing their legs, or they're, you know, they've got lipstick
okay.
on their teeth or whatever when we're meeting.
Yeah.
So 99% of my clients is by phone. So we would have a phone
okay.
call. And I would be very, I come from kind of a Columbo approach of, tell me what I don't know. You know,
all right.
I need to know and understand where you are and where you want to be, so we can build the bridge between here and there.
So initially you're going to be like Socratic. You're going to ask questions, try and provoke me to talk about what I'm thinking about, what I'm struggling about.
Correct.
Okay. So once you have a sense of that, then what do you do next? Once you kind of have a feel for what might be early steps to help me overcome what I'm in pain about?
Well, first of all, I have to get your agreement of where you are, and a recognition of kind of the state of the union, right? The state of where you are, and an agreement on where you want to be. So I get really crystal clear on where we're headed, because you won't feel successful in the work, and we won't have success in the work if we don't have a clear understanding of where our target is. Knowing that over time, if we work together, we might shift the target, because we might recognize that you had your eye on the wrong ball, right?
Okay.
We're trying to get to someplace you didn't want to be. And then from there, we look at very clear action steps of things that, you know, barriers that have been keeping you from that place, identifying what those are, and then working. I was trained as a therapist, although I work as a coach. And so I'm very experiential in my approach. So I don't have like, hey, on our first visit, you get homework assignments 1, 2, and 3.
Can I interject on, you know, because it's really important. Yeah. I think Chris asked an excellent question. I'm just curious about something, because I've seen some people that go to therapists.
Yep.
And I'm aghast because sometimes I've been going to him for like 20 years.
Right.
And I don't say anything, but I'm thinking, are you kidding me?
Right.
Yeah. So what's your time frame? I mean, I don't get that. I think that's almost malpractice.
Well, it's okay. So let me, without disparaging my therapy friends, you know, both in therapy and conducting therapy. Therapy has a usefulness, and a lot of people do use therapy, especially when what you're talking about is usually talk therapy, and they use it as support and as an outside person to give them a different vantage point, different tools, different ideas about, you know, things that are going on in their lives. And yeah, they might do that for 20 years because, hey, I've had friends for 20 years who have been listening to my problems. I'm just not paying them. So I think there's that, there are those people and there are those situations. I think that people often ask me, because they know that I'm trained as a therapist for work as a coach, is what's the difference? The difference for me is very simple. When I look at the way that I would conduct therapy, although I would probably do it now more as a coach than as a therapist, I'm very goal-directed. Like I said, I ask the person, where do you want to be? And then we develop the plan on how to get there. Therapy is, yes, looking for pain and symptom relief, but they're not necessarily as goal-directed, and they're also looking backward more than I do. I go as far back as I need to get useful information so that I can understand how the person is presenting today. I'm not looking to try to heal yesterday in today. I'm trying to get someone to heal today so that they can move to tomorrow. So it's really a time orientation and a tactical difference. I'm going to be gentle and because I care about people, but I'm not coming at it from a therapy perspective of I'm looking to move them. I mean, I call myself a cage rattler. I'm pretty open about that. I'm going to move them in a very clear but very compassionate way. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking to move them, and that's my focus.
Marty here, and I'm going to try to take you back in those 30 years and make that a moment now in terms of, let's say that they were in middle school. I'm a public school educator.
Okay.
And, you know, we're moving towards mindfulness activities and emotional intelligences. And, you know, these are things that perhaps will negate some of your clients in the future.
I hope so.
So, you know, what is your thoughts in terms of, I don't know if it's early intervention, but early awareness, and, you know, where do you see that in terms of maybe the past generation that you're working with never had those opportunities? Maybe they did. I don't know if this is a factor. But the fact that kids are now becoming more aware of their emotions, finding ways to strategize, goal setting, that kind of thing.
I absolutely love that movement. I actually wrote a book for teens on communication and conflict because, and I said this, and I've said this in presentations I've done to teen audiences, if I had had this book when I was younger, oh my goodness, the things I could have avoided. Because I think it is absolutely imperative that we start having conversations with our young people earlier to make them, whatever you want to call it, emotionally intelligent, you know, aware, mindful, something to slow down the impulsiveness and the kind of crisis drama orientation that we have in our generation and the one behind us and the one ahead of us have been feeling of this this impulsivity, the violence, like all of the things that are happening in our world right now are so much because we are not individually in our own power and clarity. And a lot of that comes, I do a lot of work with mindfulness with my clients, of being mindful, of being aware, of making choices, of recognizing that every single thought, feeling, and behavior that we have is predicated on choice. And getting to our young people and putting them in that position of responsibility over their thoughts, feelings, and actions coming from a mindful place, I think absolutely will put people like me out of business, and thank you for it.
Very good. Interesting. This is Jeff again, and I'm going to, before I throw it out to Chris, and by the way, I think, gentlemen, you would all agree, Dr. Cooper's doing well for Walt Hampton. She's
how many mountains have you climbed?
There you go.
okay, listen. Listen, he has me beat. I am asthmatic and lazy. He can climb all the mountains. I'm going to just work in this purview. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Cooper, like a kind of a 30,000-foot question.
Yeah.
Through your experience as a therapist, as a coach, as a cage rattler, have you identified, let's say, actions, emotions of, I'm putting it in quotations, of the loser, and actions and emotions of the winner or achiever?
Yeah, it comes down to a sense of power. People who feel like they have some effect on the outcome in their lives, that they are maybe not responsible for every last thing that happens, maybe not responsible for, you know, all of this, the motions of the universe and, you know, all of the things that may come into play, but that they understand that they have such control over what they think, feel, and how they behave, that they can affect change in their lives, in their world. The people who are winning are coming from that vantage point. They are not in a victim mentality. The people who are, in air quotes, losers, those people are in a victim mentality. They are, the world is doing unto them, therefore nothing they feel like they do can have any effect, and so they make a whole lot of bad choices in that. I once spoke to my daughter's elementary school classroom. They were in second grade, and I came in to talk about volunteerism, and the place that I had been volunteering was in a jail. And they were very curious about, you know, inmates and what does that look like. And I said, it's really simple. Why your parents are so clear with you on making good decisions is because the inmates that I work with have either made one really big bad decision or a series of bad decisions. That is the only thing that separates you from them. So I think that's, and we make good decisions when we recognize where our power is. So that's really the big difference.
So it's Chris. Thank you. When you talk about power like you do,
yeah,
how closely related is that to personal responsibility? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, it is all about personal responsibility, but it's more than that, because personal responsibility, I think, has been used in some forums as trying to evoke guilt. And I think personal responsibility is all about feeling powerful, not feeling responsible necessarily, but feeling powerful, feeling like I can walk into this room and I can make decisions about where I'm going to go, how I'm going to be, what I'm going to do, and that's a very it's a good place to be. Having, you know, of course, personal responsibility is a part of it, but to me, it's an energetic shift. When I know I have personal responsibility, sure, I feel like I have personal responsibility. When I feel powerful, there's something even about that word that gets me and puts me in a different frame of mind.
It makes sense.
And I'm sure Walt Hampton feels powerful when he hits the bottom of each one of those mountains he climbs.
Yep, that's right.
He does feel personal responsibility, but he feels powerful.
Yep, and that's a tactic that here in the classroom that, you know, when you can use a few words of encouragement or help a kid who's a little bit more in doubt in terms of their own skills and let them know that you think it's great, it's amazing what you get the next day.
Right.
When they've been able to build up a little self-confidence. But I want to go in the other direction in terms of the idea of disappointment. I find that people that are having a real hard time being disappointed. And I'm wondering if, you know, we've had it I know we talk about the winners, everybody gets a trophy kind of thing. So it obviously must be out there because it's just kind of a standard notion. And, you know, what kind of damage or have we done damage for perhaps your clients that have always gotten an award and now they can't handle disappointment? Are we doing a disservice to our kids that everybody gets a certificate and that you get a trophy for participation? Or should you have a chance to, as I did growing up in sports, go home crying because you lost the game?
I think it's an excellent question. Let me just elaborate one thing. Marty, that's an excellent question. Not even just in the classroom or in, you know, organized events. I've seen parents of some, you know, people I know that, oh, it's okay, don't worry. They never had to deal with crap. And
right.
Now that as an adult, they can't change the oil in their car. It's like, you know, they're incapable.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And they've had things handed to them, and they haven't been able to, again, develop self-esteem. Self-esteem doesn't come from winning. self-esteem comes from seeing that your actions have an equal reaction, right? That you do something and you have volition, you have an impact. That's where self-esteem comes from, whether it be positive or negative, whether it be failing or succeeding. And so I think we do our kids and just people in general a disservice when we shelter them from the opportunity to develop good self-esteem, from being able to, I have to go back to the prison example. I spoke at the prison, I was talking to the inmates, and a lot of them were feeling, you can imagine, all sorts of shame and guilt over what the bad choices they'd made. And they said, how can I ever face my kids? And I said, you know what, here's the thing. No kid wants a perfect parent. What every kid needs is a parent who messes up, falls in their face in front of them, and shows them how to get back up. Because that's what kids need to figure out how to do. They don't need to learn how to be perfect, how to be impenetrable, how to be without, you know, criticism. They need to learn how to make an absolute mess of things and then fix it. So as parents, as educators, as mentors, as friends, as anything, that's what we have to do. We have to show our failures as much as we show our successes so that other people can feel okay doing that and learn from that so that they can pick themselves back up.
Do you think children today, Dr. Cooper, feel more powerful on balance than they did, say, a generation ago? We've spent a lot of time, energy, and thought in cultivating good young men and women. But do you think kids today on balance feel more powerful than they did in past generations?
I think they feel differently powerful. I mean, I think in a lot of ways they have ways of communicating, of completing things that they've, you know, we didn't have. If we wanted to find our way to get someplace, we had to pull out a map and it might take us hours, right?
Yeah.
But they can now, they're like, Google map, done, right? So I think in some ways they feel a lot more powerful. But in a lot of ways, I feel, you know, some young people, and this is not everybody, we're doing big broad brushstrokes, feel a lot more pressure and perhaps not as much empowerment to be able to figure things out, to be able to, again, problem solve when they have fewer resources, when they don't have all of the answers at their fingertips. And one of the things I did with my kids, we drove cross country, and I said, put the phone away, we're not using Google Maps. And I handed them an atlas, and when we wanted to stay at, you know, find a hotel to stay in at night, I said, well, figure out how many miles per hour we're driving, you know, and figure out how many hours we want to spend on the road, figure out what city is going to have a hotel in it, and then you can look on Expedia.
I would have to say Rand McNally's probably not a good stock to get into.
They had to figure out
how. No, I'm just kidding. I think that's an excellent idea.
They felt more powerful.
And by the way, on that note, by the way, it's been an excellent show, but I have to say really interesting in that, you know, in terms of being disconnected, you know, I'm turning from technology. I remember a friend of mine got divorced. So he moved into a house and he had no TV, no nothing for a while. That was like the greatest summer ever because he just hung out on his deck, a bunch of guys and, you know, gals, and just hung out and had a good time. We actually talked. And then when he got the TV and everything else, we never went over there again. But anyway, Dr. Bridget Cooper, excellent show. Gentlemen, I would have to, right? I mean, totally awesome.
Thank you.
Yes, you did a great job.
You have some books for sale, right?
And yes, you did a great job. And on that note that Marty said in the books, how does any of our listeners get in touch with you if they want to make use of your services? And how do our listeners get in if they're interested in, let's talk about one other thing, books. You said you've written books.
Yeah, so I've written five, actually.
Five.
So,
and
yeah, so they can find my books on Amazon, and if they look up Dr. Bridget Cooper, they can find my books on Amazon. And if they want to reach me, they can go to my website, and you can fill out a form or shoot me an email or my phone to text or call.
And your website is?
DrBridgetCooper.com.
Yeah, that's easy enough. Dr. Bridget Cooper, thank you so much for being on The Buzz. You'll have to come on again soon.
Excellent. Thanks, guys.
Great. Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, that was quite a good little segment, gentlemen. I think you guys all did a great job in the kind of questions that you answered.